Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you all for coming this morning. And again, as you mentioned, my name is David Weindorf, and I'm a professor of pedology at Texas Tech. And I've got one of my students here, Bogdan Duda, a doctoral student in my program, and he's also a co-author here on this presentation, along with Delana Pearson and Sam Subra Chakraborty at the Indian Institute of Technology in Kharagpur, India. What I want to talk to you about today is proximal sensors more generally. We just heard a great presentation about EM mapping and those kind of things. That's a widely used technology, and I'll mention those briefly here as well. But my group is really focused more on portable X-ray fluorescence technology, as well as visible near-infrared diffuse reflectance spectroscopy. And at first glance, when you hear those kind of terms, a lot of people gloss over and they think, oh, geez, this is going to be super complicated. I will tell you that with the X-ray fluorescent spectrometer right here, both my 17-year-old and my 14-year-old kids have published a total of 3 peer-reviewed papers using those technologies. So if my kids can use it, I guarantee you consultants can use it. It's really not that complicated, okay? So I want to start off by just asking you a question, and that is, what's the problem with this soil? You get a phone call as a consultant, hey, I want to grow some tomatoes out here, and the soil just doesn't look bueno. Is this a problem with pH or salinity? Is it a soil texture issue? Low cation exchange capacity? Lacking organic matter? Is it polluted? Maybe all of the above. In fact, this particular soil that you're looking at right here is on a mine tailings pile in South Africa. And they're trying to revegetate this, but of course, the substrate, the material that they're trying to grow stuff in, has very extreme properties. And so really the only way that we could definitively identify what the problems are with this soil traditionally would be to go and collect a sample or lots of samples, as you mentioned, go back to the lab and do some testing. Well, there's lots of different proximal sensors that could also address these types of issues. And some of these that I'm going to discuss are the portable X-ray fluorescence, electromagnetic induction, the VisNear DRS, ground-penetrating radar has been around quite a long time. Jim Doolittle's done a lot of that work. Laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy, or LIBS, is a newer technology that's coming on the market. So there's lots of these types of sensor platforms that could potentially be brought to bear on these problems. Now, some of these instruments provide you with direct readings from which interpretations can be made. So on my PXRF gun, when I put it down on the soil and I pull the trigger and zap it, it's literally giving me about 25 different elements on the screen in 60 seconds. So I have direct information right there. LIBS kind of works the same way. Other types of detectors provide you some sort of a data stream that you can make interpretations off of. So this would be VisNear DRS, where you have a continuous reflectance spectrum from 350 to 2500 nanometers at 1 nanometer intervals, or EMI, where you're getting apparent electrical conductivity, ground penetrating radar. These signals that are received back from the second type of sensor have to be interpreted. And our previous speaker talked about that a little bit, the need for those algorithms to kind of interpret that and tell us what it means in the context of soil science. Well, as a class of instruments, these proximal sensors are rapid, they're non-destructive, they allow for high throughput of samples. You can do hundreds in a single day. They offer wide dynamic range. So, for instance, very low limits of detection to very high concentrations with no need for dilutions or things like that. Limited sample preparation. In fact, some don't need any sample prep at all. You can just zap it right in the field. These instruments are portable, so you can make readings in the field. And also, when you collect a single data stream, you can make many different interpretations off of the same data stream. So it's very powerful, robust data. But there are some drawbacks to these technologies as well. Initially, the cost of this instrumentation can be high. It varies instrument by instrument, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But for instance, the VisNear is around $60,000 to $70,000. The XRF is around $40,000. Some of these instruments require some specialized training for certain applications, especially if you're doing advanced statistical analysis. Bo can speak to that, right? Variable requirement for interpretation. Again, some provide direct data, but some you have to interpret a little bit. And these are generally a little bit less established than traditional lab methods. Some of them are really gaining worldwide appeal now, but some people always say, well, what is LIBS again? I haven't really heard of that. You know, it's fairly new, so there's still kind of an acquisition of the technology going on as well. Well, the accuracy of these proximal sensors can be affected by environmental considerations, site variables, even variables in the modeling data set. So moisture, field heterogeneity, management practices. I was talking about the size of that modeling data set. You know, we could create a model based on hundreds of samples or thousands of samples or millions of samples. And some of the larger countries and continents are doing just that. You know, the Natural Resources Conservation Service at the National Lab has a PXRF and a VisNir, and they're creating these robust databases of all sorts of data that they've collected from thousands of soil profiles that have been sampled. They're doing that in Africa and Australia as well. Bo and I have been working on some of that for Eastern Europe as well. But take something like field heterogeneity and realize that the aperture of the PXRF is only about the size of a dime, maybe a nickel. Okay? When you're scanning a soil profile, if you happen to hit something like an iron manganese concretion, you're going to get a really high reading. And you could literally move over an inch and scan it again and get a reading that's totally different. And that doesn't mean that the equipment is malfunctioning. It just means that our soils are naturally that variable. Things like calcium carbonate concretions, gypsum crystals, again, the iron manganese. There's all kinds of things that vary within profiles at the centimeter scale. Okay? So some of these interpretations that we talk about provide accuracy comparable to lab analysis. And in other cases, these sensors yield qualitative to semi-quantitative data. So this begs the question, how accurate is the data? If the quality isn't exactly like lab data, why not just use lab data? Well, cost and speed of analysis. And in many cases, the data that we receive from these instruments is qualitative or better. So the example that I like to give of this is, think about collecting a soil sample and shipping it off for a standard lab characterization. A conservative estimate of that might be $50, right? I mean, oftentimes you're going to pay more for that, for micronutrients, organic carbon, texture, you know, all that stuff, pH, salinity, whatnot. So you're going to pay $50 a sample. What if I told you that I could give you data for 200 samples, but do it at 25 cents a sample, and the trade-off would be that the accuracy is 80 to 90% of what we had with the lab data? A lot of people would take that trade-off. And that's really what we're talking about with a lot of these proximal sensors. I always tell people, if you need the ultimate in analytical accuracy, yeah, you need to collect a soil sample and send it to the lab. I'm not going to dispute that. But for developing countries, for a quick look in the field, for refining our sampling schemes, there are so many applications, for consulting applications, where you don't have to have absolute 100% analytical accuracy. 90% would probably work for most of your applications. Okay? So, again, kind of hearkening back to what was mentioned earlier by Shannon and some others, you remember these, right? The Heliga-Truog kit, colorimetric test for pH. Of course, we've all been out there texturing soils by hand, doing nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium colorimetrically, calcium carbonate developmental stages, kind of a morphological description of what we're seeing in the field. We've used qualitative description of soils for a long time in soil survey, and I'm not suggesting we throw those out. What I'm suggesting, and this was the title of my talk, these proximal sensors represent a new tool in the tool belt of the modern soil scientist and the modern consultant. And they shouldn't be the only tool, but they represent a new stream of data and information that can give you a better idea of what you're looking at. Let me just give you some examples of how this data lines up with lab data using VisNir spectroscopy. For measuring total carbon content, we're getting an R-square of 0.91. Carbon to nitrogen ratio, 0.88. Cation exchange capacity, 0.88. Copper, 0.82. So we're seeing 80 to 90% accuracy, but realize that these studies right here are 15 to 20 years old. We've come a long way even since then, and I'll talk more about that in a little bit. But this work here, this paper, is published by Viscara-Russell. Total nitrogen content, 94. Organic carbon, organic matter, you see really good results with these. So even if you need the ultimate in analytical accuracy or lab data, you can still use these proximal sensors to refine your field or laboratory sampling scheme, or to differentiate what we call remarkable from non-remarkable samples. And the example I like to give is, Bogdan had set all these samples out on the table, right, and he's getting ready to scan all these with VisNir. What if I decided to come in and spike one of those with just a little bit of arsenic? And I said, good luck, tell me which one it is. The only way he'd be able to figure that out is to digest each one, run an ICP analysis on it, you know, and wait and wait and wait. Or we could scan each of those samples with XRF or VisNear, say, aha, it's that one right there. Then take that one sample to the lab and digest it and get the ultimate in analytical accuracy with that one sample. So again, remarkable versus unremarkable samples. Just that right there could save a tremendous amount of money for consultants and farmers. So let me go through each of these technologies and tell you a little bit about these. These are the kind of the backgrounds on portable X-ray fluorescence. Essentially what happens here is each element has electron shells around it. In an X-ray fluorescence, what happens is the gun shoots out a low-power X-ray. It ejects one of these inner shell electrons, just gone, out of the shell. An outer shell electron then cascades down to fill the inner shell, but in order to do that, it has to give up energy. That energy that it releases is the fluorescence that the aperture, the detector within the gun, detects, and it is unique to each element. And that's what allows for us to determine if it's copper, zinc, lead, chromium, arsenic, whatever. And then obviously the number of counts that you get gives an indication of how much you have in concentration-wise, right? So this is my instrument that we use in my lab. It's a battery-operated Olympus Delta DP6000. It features a rhodium X-ray tube. We operate that at 10 to 40 kiloelectron volts. To put that in context for you, that's lower power than a dental X-ray, okay? We standardize this with a calibration coin. My instrument features soil mode or geochem mode. These are just packages of different elements that you can, you know, get from the manufacturer. And there are lots of different companies that make this equipment. Rigaku, Thermoniton, you name it. Lots of them out there, okay? My instrument costs around $40,000. And one thing I might mention for consultants is that you can rent this equipment. You don't have to pay $40,000 up front. You can rent it for a few hundred dollars a day. They'll ship it to you in a Pelican case, FedEx. It shows up. You literally pull it out of the case, turn it on, and go right to work. So you could, you know, collect a bunch of samples from the field or take it to the field for a day or two and then just ship it right back. So these are some of the different elements that you get with X-ray fluorescence. And again, what impressed me about this technology is the robustness of the data. It's not a single stream of data. You're getting 25 different elements simultaneously in the field in 60 seconds. And what generally happens, and you see this reflected in the periodic table here, is the larger the electron shell, the more sensitive the detection limits, because there are more electrons to create the fluorescence. It does not do well with the lighter elements, you know, sodium, lithium, nitrogen, carbon. We really can't do those with X-ray fluorescence. But by the time we're getting down to calcium, potassium, then iron, copper, zinc, all those, you know, we're talking 5 to 10 parts per million accuracy in the field, which is really tremendous technology. I was liken it to Star Trek. Bo made that analogy the other day. You know, with the tricorder, you know, when they land on a new planet. There are several reference methods for the use of portable X-ray fluorescence now for soils analysis. The most notorious of which is the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Method 6200. This came out in 2007. The NRCS published a method in their Soil Survey Field and Laboratory Methods Manual, and the Soil Science Society of America also has a published method now as well. So there are lots of applications of this, everything from textural determination, pH, salinity, cation exchange capacity, base saturation percentage, plant essential elements, mineralogy, heavy metals, lots of different things. I'll talk about some of those. I've mentioned the advantages: non-destructive, rapid, multi-elemental, wide dynamic range, low limits of detection. The disadvantages for this particular technology are no hydrogen, carbon, or sodium. Moisture effects. The literature generally says when there's more than 20% moisture, you need to make a moisture correction. And again, soil heterogeneity, when we have these little pockets of calcium carbonate or things like that. Typically, when we do this type of analysis in my lab, we bring the sample back to the lab, we dry and grind it, and that kind of homogenizes the soil and gives us a more uniform soil to look at with the XRF. So let me give you a couple of application examples of this. We know that soil salinity can be a problem and promote desertification, degrade soil quality. We also know that salts are typically combinations of calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium sulfate, chlorine, carbonate, and bicarbonate. We can't read all of those with XRF, but all the ones in green we can. Okay? So in addition to just getting electrical conductivity as a saturated paste, extract, or something like that, which just tells you the electrical conductance between those two metal plates, This technology can also tell you some of the cations and anions associated with that salinity. Okay? So these traditional slurries that we've, you know, relied on, they're laborious, ex situ, and they don't tell you anything about the type of salt present. So to evaluate this, we collected 121 soil samples back when I was on the faculty at LSU in Louisiana parishes, is what they call them down there. We made our XRF scans and then compared those to both the slurry that we make, the saturated paste, you know, using a digital salinity bridge. And we had a model 4063 cc. And the salinity range that we tested here was substantial, everything from 0.1 to almost 80 decisiemens per meter, and realized that a saline soil is only 4 decisiemens per meter. So some of these were quite saline. And this is what we essentially found. You know, with our calibration equations, we're getting R squares against electrical conductance of 0.83 with a simple linear regression and 0.90 with a multiple linear regression. We put some validation statistics on that as well. They're around 0.7 to 0.8. We published this in 2014. This was my master student, Samantha Swanhart, who published this article in Soil Science. Well, we feel like this soil salinity then can be reasonably inferred using this elemental data, and we can identify some of the potential salts contributing to that. You know, sylvite, gypsum, things like that could be identified using this type of technique. And also remember, when you make that one scan and you collect all of that elemental data, we're not just able to predict salinity off of that. We can do a lot of other soil parameters off of that same data set. Well, we thought, you know, this works pretty well for soil. Why don't we try it with water? And the same sort of thing, you know, you don't know what type of salt is present when you dip that EC meter in some salty water, right? You would run that on ICP or atomic absorption or something like that. But we thought, you know what, let's go ahead and put these water samples in special cups, cover them with a film, and take a look at what we can do. The possible extension of this was not limited to just salty water, but we wanted to start thinking about metals in water. Think the lead crisis in Flint, Michigan, for instance, right? Things like that. So we collected these soil samples, we put them in these little plastic cups, we sealed those with something called a proline thin film, which is a special type of plastic which allows for maximum X-ray transmissivity, and we put them in this little hooded test stand. You obviously don't want to hold it in your hand when you're zapping it with X-rays. So you put it in the hooded test stand, close that, and that protects the end user from any errant X-rays. And so looking at something like chlorine, what we were able to find is a validation R-square of 0.77. So even in a liquid matrix using soil mode, which is not tuned specifically for a water matrix density of 1.0, we still got really good validation R-square here. So this led us to think, well, if it's working this well for salty water, maybe we ought to just take a look at some metals in solution. You know what? We've got some ICP standards on the shelf. They say on the bottle it's supposed to be 1,000 parts per million lead. Why don't we take a look at that? Well, when we scanned that 1,000 parts per million lead, we got readings of 998 or 981, 962, 958. Pretty good. Okay? Just right out of the bottle. So imagine when there's a crisis like this happening in Flint, or when we had the Animas River spill, the Gold King mine spill in Colorado moving down into New Mexico, and they called me and asked me to bring my equipment out there and scan the stuff on site. And EPA is going around and they're kind of collecting some samples here and there, but they don't have any numbers. And I'm able to provide data instantly. My phone rings, I pick it up. It's the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. They said, we'd like for you to testify in Congress next week on your data because we don't have any from anybody else yet. Okay? That's the kind of power this technology brings to the table. What about pH? Now, this is a really crazy one. You say, Weindorf, you told us this thing won't read hydrogen, right? How are you going to measure the negative logarithm of the hydrogen ion concentration if you can't read hydrogen? Well, the beauty of pH in soils is it's often associated with other elements. So alkaline soils tend to have lots of calcium and magnesium in them, and acidic soils tend to have lots of iron and aluminum. And all four of those elements we can read with XRF. So we essentially use those elements as a proxy for determining soil pH. And think about the special applications of this. Lorene works up in Alaska where they have lots of permafrost. The only way to test the pH on that permafrost is to thaw it out. You got to insert the probe, right, to test that. Well, we can scan the frozen permafrost with the XRF and determine the pH while it's still frozen. What about lithified soils? What about those soil monoliths hanging up on the university museum, right? If you know when those soils were collected, maybe 40 years ago, or where those were collected, I can literally scan it on the wall as a monolith. We can go back to that same site today and look at temporal change over a 40-year time span. Pretty neat stuff. So when we compare this to just a normal pH meter, we're getting an R-squared here of 0.77 and a root mean square error of 0.68. Think about this as a consultant in terms of micronutrient availability. Obviously, pH is something that farmers are really interested in. So Akriti Sharma was a master student of mine. She published this work in Geoderma in 2014. She also looked at cation exchange capacity, and if anyone's had to do this in the laboratory as a grad student, you know it's a pain in the ass. I mean, you've got to do all kinds of mixing and decanting and, you know, just back and forth, vortexing stuff. You'll work all day to get 15 samples done if you're lucky, okay? But when we talk about cation exchange capacity, what are we talking about? We're talking about calcium, magnesium, potassium, copper, zinc, manganese, iron. Those are all cations. They're all plant essential elements, and we can read all of them with XRF. Okay? So there's lots of different methods for doing this in a laboratory sense, you know, the ammonium acetate method or sodium acetate method or whatever, but you're obviously not going to be doing those in the field because you need ICP quantification at the end. So scanning these with XRF, we were able to get an R-square 0.91 almost, 0.908 relative to laboratory determined CEC. Again, think about this in a consulting sense of mobile analysis labs, real-time soil fertility mapping. You know, we can collect all of this data. Each place that we go and we do a scan in the field, we georeference that with GPS, take all of that data at the end of the day, dump it into ArcGIS, do a Krieging interpolation, and create a spatial variability map right there on site sitting in the pickup truck. Very easily, I'll tell you, with this XRF technology, we can go around field and scan 150 points in a single day. I've done that many times. So that's pretty powerful tech. Okay? There's lots of other XRF applications. I don't want to bore you with all of these. Lithologic discontinuity identification, enhanced PEDON horizonation, gypsum quantification, calcium carbonate developmental stage. I got to give a little shout out on that one. That was my daughter's eighth grade science project, and it got published in the Soil Science Society of America journal using XRF. Okay. Characterization of podzols, you know, the spodosols, evaluation of heavy metals and mine tailings. I've done a lot of that work in Eastern Europe and in India. Plant essential nutrient analysis. We're now moving on to further testing of waters and vegetation using this technology, and really it provides a lot of good information. Well, the next technology I want to move on to is Visnier spectroscopy, and this is also a very simple technology, but it's technology that provides data that we have to interpret. So you scan a light or shine a light onto the soil. Some of that light hits the soil, right, is absorbed, but some of it also bounces back. And we operate here in the visible and near-infrared spectrum from 350 to 2500 nanometers. So again, here's kind of a little graphic of how this works. Christine Morgan made this years ago. You see this diffuse reflectance coming back. That's what we're able to measure very precisely. I mean, at 1 nanometer wavelengths. Bo can attest to the fact that when we download these data sets, they download right into Microsoft Excel, and they're megabytes in size. When's the last time you saw an Excel sheet that was a megabyte in size? And it's because it's just a voluminous amount of data that you have. These are a couple of different instruments that are out there. The AgriSpec DRS from Analytical Spectral Devices. That one's around $60,000. The one we use in my lab is this PSM 3500 from Spectral Evolutions. They actually have a booth here at the meeting if you want to stop by and see some of their technology. This one is now a little bit older. You know, they have a newer model that's even fancier. It has a fancier metal shell on it. But mine was about $75,000, and it works really well. So, you know, I've listened to lots of different researchers talk about this technology. David Brown, Travis Weiser, Christine Morgan at Texas A&M did a lot of work in this area. And Christine and I are talking one day, and she's giving this presentation about how well this works for organic carbon. She's talking about mineralogy and texture and soil moisture and all these other things. And I said, well, Christine, if it works really well for carbon, how would it work on hydrocarbon pollution in the soil? She's like, well, that's a great question. We ought to do a study. So we did. So this was the basic premise. Think about a soil that is contaminated and non-contaminated, but it's the exact same soil series. Okay, just pick whatever series you want. We pick two soils, and we put some oil on one, put some oil on one, and then also evaluated the non-contaminated versions of that soil. What we find is you see reflectance on the y-axis and wavelength on the x-axis, again from 350 to 2500. What happens is when you pollute the soil with hydrocarbons, it causes a spectral absorbance. And this offset that you see between the solid lines and the dashed lines is something we can measure very precisely. And that's something that gives us an indication of how much pollution is in the soil. Specifically, we look at combinations of different wavelengths that are associated with compounds like total petroleum hydrocarbon, hexane, benzene, other things that we would want to look at. So for this particular study, we evaluated the soils as field moist intact aggregates, air dry intact aggregates, and then air dry ground samples. And what we actually found was that the best results were produced by field moist in situ aggregates. If you think about it, the more you dry and process the soil, the more that oil is going to volatilize. So we actually got the best results doing it in the field with the field moist samples. So here's an application of this, calling all consultants. There was a little spill called the Deepwater Horizon, right? And my phone rang, and it was the Coast Guard. And they said, we want to see your technology down here on Grand Isle, Louisiana, immediately. So we took it down there, and this was actually oil from the Deepwater Horizon that I scooped up at Pensacola Beach, Florida. And we took that, and we took some clean sand over here, and we mixed those in different combinations. I think you can see that. We created a whole range of contamination, right, to kind of check out how the instrument would work. What essentially happens here is we have clean sand right up here providing a lot of reflectance. Then by the time you add some tar balls into that, the reflectance comes way down. And by the time you get to heavy oil, the reflectance is very low. Again, that offset in the reflectance peak height gives us an indication of exactly how much total petroleum hydrocarbon we're looking at. Now, I have to tell you, in doing this at Pensacola Beach, this was really the best case scenario for me to test this technology. You're looking for black oil on white sand with no organic matter around. I mean, it was just the perfect setup, right? And so lo and behold, when we look at the R-squares that we got relative to Soxhlet extraction, you know, which we would do in the lab for TPH quantification, we're getting R-squares of 0.95. And when we log scale that, we get it up to 0.99, okay? So we packaged this up, you know, we said, hey, this is really great. We're demonstrating this for officials from British Petroleum and for the Coast Guard. We've got a copy of the Coast Guard's internal report. They said, we highly recommend this technology for immediate deployment across this spill and all future spills because it really shows exactly how much pollution is there. We offered that technology to BP. They wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, okay? Because they don't want to know how much pollution is there. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. You know, people always say, well, it's clean, right? Well, how clean is clean? Believe me, I can tell you with this instrument how clean is. Okay. All right, electromagnetic induction. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because our previous speaker spoke about some of this as well. But this is one of the most commonly used proximal sensors. And most of you are familiar with the Veris instrument, which has kind of a coulter that goes down into the ground. This yellow tube right here is the one that I have in my lab that's a dual-M system. And then the EM38 is one from Geonix that's also very popular and widely used. It kind of looks like a carpenter's level. Essentially, the way this technology works is there's a transmitting coil on one end, and there are receiving coils on the other end, and it creates these kind of electrical currents within the soil. And everywhere you go with this sensor, dragging it across the field, you're also collecting GPS data. So you know exactly where you are in the field, and you can tell relative differences, and hey, this part of the field is different than that part of the field. Again, I don't know exactly what's causing that difference necessarily without further processing the data, but I know something's different, and that's where you have to start interpreting the data very carefully. There are a lot of good papers that have been published on this technology. Again, I'll point you to Doolittle's paper looking at apparent electrical conductivity across the surface, and they were able to clearly identify saline seeps. And they modeled this in 3D so you can get a good idea of where there's variability across the landscape. This is another study here identifying some potential differences in soil texture where the Sharkey silty clay loam was differentiated from the Wardell loam. And you see some other different mapping units that were expressed well by the apparent electrical conductivity. But again, it's important that the proper kind of processing and interpretation be done. Because again, we know that moisture and other things that might be encountered in the field can definitely cause differences here. I think the previous speaker did an excellent job of saying, you know, if we did this, took the sensor over the field in the spring and then did it again in the fall, probably get some different results based on moisture differences. And I absolutely agree with that 100%. Well, another technology that is starting to inch into the market a little bit is one called laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy, or LIBS. Now, this looks a lot like the XRF gun, but it's not. It's totally different. It's a battery-operated laser, and when that strikes the soil, it creates a plasma right over the soil surface, which then refracts the light in different ways and is measured by a detector. I'll show you a little graphic on that. It has a wider number of elements than XRF, and especially in the lighter elements. You can look at nitrogen, carbon, lithium, and sodium directly with LIBS. The problem is it's semi-destructive. It actually burns the surface of the soil. So it's an ablation technique, basically. So it will leave a scar on the sample. And the other major drawback to this technology is, in order to scan the samples, they have to be pelletized. You can't just go out and put it on the soil and scan it. You won't get results worth anything. You've got to compress it into a compressed pellet, and while that works great for a lot of soils, in my part of the world, in West Texas, it won't work so well for sandy soils. You just can't make a pellet out of that. Also, the soil has to be absolutely dry. If there's any kind of moisture present there at all, it will cause interference with that plasma that's generated and cause errors in the readings. So this is essentially how it works. Again, the laser comes out, creates the plasma, you get that collection of emitted light, goes through a prism, which breaks the different spectra apart, and then it's measured. And you can determine lots of different elements in this manner. Okay? There are several people using LIBS for different types of applications, and I just kind of went out on their website to look for some application notes. You know, carbon analysis and low alloy, carbon steels, first ever infield quantitative measurement of lithium in soils, infield sulfur analysis using handheld LIBS. So, I mean, there are some studies that are using this. I think more people are, my interpretation is, more people are using this in hard rock geology, where you don't have to worry about pelletizing the sample, right? You know, creating that compacted pellet. So if you have a piece of slate or something like that, some kind of rock, you can scan that pretty much directly. Also, moisture is not going to be a problem with a lot of those rocks. So I think that's one of the things that's being considered. Ground-penetrating radar has been around for a number of years. Here we essentially just have a radar signal that's sent down into the ground using this little instrument that kind of looks like a lawnmower. And those radar signals then strike different things within the soil, hard layers, pipelines, cables, things like that, and they reflect some of that radar signal back to the detector. Okay? So this is useful for the identification of rocky substrata, pipelines, grave sites. It's been used for that in places where there have been historic grave sites and people have kind of lost track of where those sites are. Also specific soil features, durapans, petrospheric, petrocalcic horizons, and the like. So here's kind of an idea of how it works. You know, you're out there in the field, you're shooting this down in there, you're hoping that it reflects some signal off of that drainage pipe, and you can see these spikes right here where they're identifying different pipes in the ground that would essentially return that signal back. And this was a paper that was published in 2014 in Applied Geology and Geophysics. This is some work that I did with Jim Doolittle and some other folks in Louisiana, where we're looking at these Ortstein layers, essentially, these hardened petrospheric contacts. And you can see this along the high wall here, exactly where those are, and we're trying to identify variability in the thickness of that and depth from the surface using this type of technique. This is actually the raw reflectance signal that you see back using ground-penetrating radar, and you can start to see the inference here of some different layers. You can put this in different colors to help you visualize it, but again, you can kind of see the depth function here as the feature of movement across the surface. Here is a map produced by Doolittle and his crew showing the suitability of ground-penetrating radar across the United States. The areas in green represent high potential for its application in soils, where the yellows, oranges, and reds represent kind of lower applicability of this type of technology. So again, it's not going to be useful everywhere in the United States, but hey, if you're living in Maine or in parts of Florida or other places, it will tend to work pretty well in those areas. Well, one thing that I did in preparing this talk was just do a quick search out in Geoderma. and take a look at how many of these different technologies came up as a hit when I put that in as a search term. LIBS had 13, PXRF was 38, ground penetrating radar 72, electromagnetic induction 109, and Vizsnir DRS 272 papers. Okay. One thing I'll say about GPR and electromagnetic induction, they've been around a long time. I mean, those technologies have been around for decades. So you would expect them to have a pretty high number of these types of citations. Vizsnir DRS is comparatively new. It's been around at least 15 to 20 years pretty readily. But, it's really taken off in a lot of labs around the world. And XRF, for being a fairly new technology, I think has also received wide acclaim. LIBS, as you can see, really hasn't been used that much in soil science that I was able to find. So while these proximal sensors are independently effective, combining them is even more powerful. And this has really been what my lab has been working on for the last 2 or 3 years. And I'm going to give you an example of combining the data streams of X-ray fluorescence and Vizsnir spectroscopy. In this technique, we use the Vizsnir spectrum as the primary modeling data, and then we feed into that elemental data from the XRF as what we call auxiliary input data. And basically what it does is give the model more information to chew on to try to resolve the most accurate model it can in reflecting the parameter of interest. So one study that we did was looking at total carbon and total nitrogen. Of course, those are two of the most important elements for soil health assessment and agronomic production. For this study, we collected 675 samples from Texas, Nebraska, California. We applied our synthesized XRF and Vizsnir approach and compared that statistically to Dumas method high temperature combustion for total carbon, total nitrogen. Some of you may have a LECO, right? That's the instrument we're talking about. So look at this. We're essentially modeling nitrogen and carbon, and we're getting an RPD of 2.90 and an R square relative to our Dumas method combustion of 0.88 for carbon and 0.89 for nitrogen, which is really good data. Bo, remind us what RPD is. Residual prediction deviation, okay? And it's essentially the root mean square error divided by the standard deviation. And what we're talking about with this RPD is Chang wrote a paper in 2001 where he said if an RPD is above 2.0, that represents a stable predictive model. If it's between 1.4 and 2, it's, okay, fair, but if it's below 1.4, it's really unstable. So you see both of these predictive models are considered stable. So both proximal sensing techniques were also used to independently predict total carbon and total nitrogen, but those results independently were less robust than the synthesized approach. So by adding these two together, we get a better predictive ability and we're able to produce better quality data. So Dan Wong, who's a visiting scientist from China in my lab, she published this paper in Geoderma back in 2015. And I could give you many other examples of this. I mean, we've done this with salinity, with hydrocarbons, with many other factors, and we've shown the same kind of things. Robust RPD values, really strong R-squares relative to laboratory data. We were so excited about this, we filed a provisional patent on this in 2014. And right now we're looking for commercial partners to potentially bring this to market. And so these are the types of things that we're talking about. We actually had a company in India approach us about a month ago expressing interest in bringing this type of technology to market. Christine Morgan at Texas A&M, working with Jason Ackerman, have created a Vizsnir penetrometer, which literally scans the soil as you push this tube down into the ground, almost like a Giddings probe. Well, I told her, Christine, that's great, but really you've only got half the package until you include my x-rays. So we're hoping that maybe at some point we can find a way to miniaturize that and get it into the bullnose of that probe as well. Okay. So if you're looking for some contemporary overviews of PXRF and Vizsnir, which I've talked a lot about today, I would point you to my paper in Advances in Agronomy in 2014, which talks about environmental, pedological, and agronomic applications. Horta's group with Alex McBratney, Budiman Manasny, and others out of the University of Sydney in Australia, they published a great paper on Vizsnir in 2015. And they actually talk up here in this paper a little bit about these combined technologies as well. So in conclusion, these rapid advances in technology have really given us soil scientists and consultants as well new tools for quantification in the field. This young man over here in the cowboy hat, that was my grandfather. And he was a soil conservationist who worked his career in eastern New Mexico. And the groups that I've talked to have always said, he could not have ever imagined that 40 years down the road, I'd be working in China with an X-ray gun looking at soils. I mean, that would just blow his mind, right? These proximal sensors produce quality data in the field in seconds. They have alacrity. You can do it very quickly. Portability, non-destructiveness, no handling of the soil samples, which is important when you're trying to import soil samples from foreign countries. A lot of this equipment is available for rental, either from commercial companies, or you might pick up the phone and call NRCS, because they're starting to get more and more of this equipment available as well. Minimal to no consumables, simultaneous assessment of many different parameters of interest. Widespread use of these techniques is underway now. So with that, I'll conclude and say thank you very much. Let's go to work. Do we have time for questions?
We have a lot of time for questions.
Okay. So any questions y'all have on this? Yes. Fertility recommendations? Yes, absolutely. I mean, both with the Visnier as well as the XRF, there's a lot of fertility measurements associated with that. You know, generally, we're talking cation exchange capacity, right, or base saturation percentage. So both of these technologies have proven effective at predicting CEC in soils where you want to do your scanning, right? But beyond that, the technologies like the LIBS or the XRF can make independent elemental quantification within the soil. Now, the one trade-off is we don't necessarily read plant available. We read total elemental concentrations. And from that, plant available is a portion of that. But, you know, for instance, there are certain ionic species, right, that are available to plants and others that aren't. This is not going to differentiate elements based on valence. It's just going to give you the total elemental content. So, again, there's still some interpretation here that's needed, right? But it does give us a really powerful data stream in the field. Yes, sir.
So if you were to combine the Visnier and the XRF into that penetrating probe to measure like organic matter in the profile, what sort of calibrations would have to go into that?
Yeah.
Soil specific calibrations.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a great question. Okay, so one thing I want to mention is I mentioned the sensitivity of XRF to moisture, right? And how you have to apply this kind of moisture correction factor. It just so happens that Visnier is very sensitive to measuring moisture, specifically at 1,940 nanometers. We actually wrote a paper on that. So one of the things that we've talked about in our lab is measuring the moisture content of the soil as you're, you know, scanning down this way, but then using that moisture content as a tuning parameter to adjust the XRF data on the backside. And all of that can be seamlessly done when you combine the two sensors, right? So, yeah, right there in the field, okay? So that would be really cool. The second part of that is, you're right, there's a lot of variability in types of soil. Think about parent materials, you know, different types of vegetation or whatever. I would never want to create a model for West Texas and bring it to Florida and apply it. It wouldn't work so well. So what we really need for the best results here are regional models. Now, if I was talking about the high plains of West Texas, the 30 counties that make up that area, we might create a model for that, and it would work great all over that. If we wanted to create a model for Central Texas, where we have thin mollisols over limestone, you know, you're talking about millions of acres of that, you know, area that you could do. So the idea is, any area that you want to have the best results in, you want to go there, build a model that represents this, and then go from there. When we're talking about bringing this to industry, what we're thinking about are some user configurations on the input side that help to define those parameters, which model will be used. So are you working in a sandy soil or a clay soil? A low organic matter soil or a high organic matter soil? Is it a farmland or native range? You know, those kinds of things will tell the computer software, okay, hey, I'm working in a farmland. I might want to look at more fertilizer type elements because it's probably there's going to be more there, right? So those are the types of inputs that we plan to put into the software.
Yeah, and so that sort of eliminates the need to go out and create all these like laboratory-based.
Right. Well, and I think what's going to happen is when we bring this instrument to market, we're going to use the databases that are already available that are extensive. So the Africa Soil Information Network, they have thousands of these scans that have been done on all their different cores. the Soil Survey Lab, Kellogg Lab in Lincoln, Nebraska. They've got thousands of these, right? Australia has these. I mean, lots of different places have thousands of these cores where we can take all of that data and use that data to kind of enhance our models, right? And, you know, you're working with somebody like NRCS, that's a public resource. It's not proprietary or anything like that. They just scan it and here's the data, you know? So, yeah. So we have a lot of, we don't have to build all that from scratch. It's already out there. It's just assembling it. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Well, for all the way with vis near and near infrared, you're looking to 2,500.
So, if you could get detection ranges down to the 200 range, mm-hmm. do you think you could separate out nitrate nitrogen for photo nitrogen and I think the detection range for nitrate is around 230.
Right, yeah. That's something we haven't looked at, but several people have brought that up. Wouldn't it be great to differentiate ammonium from nitrate from nitrite? I mean, yeah, those are the kinds of things that remain to be done with this type of technology, and it's totally on the table to do it. We just need another grad student project working on that. I mean, literally, the groups that are working in these technology areas, we are publishing papers as fast as we can write them. In my team this year at Texas Tech, we've published 13 papers, okay? And that's because the data acquisition side of this is so fast. Normally, you know, a lot of people have to write a paper. They have to go out and work months or years to collect the data. We can collect the data we need for a research study in 3 days, easily, okay? And then it's just statistical processing and that sort of thing to figure it out. So, Bo can tell you, written on the chalkboard in our lab is we have to move at the speed of science, right? And this is an area of science that is really hitting right now. We have an opportunity here to be a game changer for an entire industry worldwide as it relates to soil testing. And again, do not mistake me. I'm not saying close all the soil labs. Not at all, okay? What I'm saying are for you consultants in the room, for people who need a quick look, for when we have an environmental disaster that occurs, we need quick answers, right? And that's when all this equipment and technology can be brought to bear. So, yeah. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think you know, the best way to do that is partnerships, right? So I loan my equipment out to people all over the country and all over the world, and I'm not looking for any financial gain off of that, just advancement of the science. You know, I recently, a month or so ago, I was down in Brazil, and I was looking at oxisols, and I was telling them about the cool stuff we could do with these kinds of technologies if we just set up a research project, you know? So it's like, you have a place I can stay, you know, can I charge up my batteries there? I mean, that really, that's all we need to do something like that. So doing a project like this really doesn't involve a lot of money. We have the equipment, other people have the equipment that you can borrow from, and we'd be happy to partner with you in those aspects. NRCS, I'm sure, would you know, donate some expertise as well. And what that helps all of us do is create a better database, because we have samples from the South, from the West, from Alaska, I mean, all over the different places, and that the more variability we capture in the models, the better the models will be. So, yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, Lorraine, sure.
I just want to know what your grad student is observing.
That's actually me in the pit. So, you know, sometimes you really got to get that sample deep down in there, and they had a lot of fun with that picture, believe it or not. So, yeah, that's right. All right, thank you guys.
Great topic. So our next presenter is Leo Rivera. And Leo comes to us from Decagon/Meter Group. And he got his MS degree from in soil science from Texas A&M. And he is one of the lead forces in the development of Decagon soil moisture sensors and infiltrometers. Leo?